Hello and welcome to the Decibel Boost Podcast monthly album roundup for the month of September 2022. I am your host Robert, and as always, fuck Christopher Columbus. Instead, let's celebrate Meals by Cuji on TikTok instead. That's a real Italian hero. And with me I have...
Risho's sick as a dog. I deserve a lot of cold medicine after this.
And...
Hey, I bought 28 bucks. What can I spend on this?
Probably a lot of things, you know. Maybe a Blu-ray. Probably like a video game that's on sale for half off. I mean, there are some things that you can buy a lot of things at $28. Including apparently also Taco Bell.
I feel like that's the in real life version of, I need help for my budget. And then you see like $6,000 for candles.
Help me, please. My family is dying.
Why do so many quote-unquote smart people do the drill tweet things?
I don't know. You spent $20 on Taco Bell. What did you order?
If you're spending $28 for lunch at Taco Bell, you have more problems you need to worry about.
Did you order a cum?
You better have been at least with one other person, because that's the only way that makes sense.
Yeah, I was about to say, because mostly a cum will cost, maybe close to $7, $8 to $10 a combo, or at least you better, I don't know, get some, because I don't call this stuff and just get drunk, you can buy, a Nachos Bel Grande, Mexican pizza, some tacos, some of them $2 burritos.
Mark, you're getting me really hungry for Taco Bell. That's not a very good idea.
Look, the point is, what the hell kind of weed does one person have to smoke to order that much Taco Bell at once? Like, even if you're accounting for pricing on the higher end, that's like three people's worth of food right there.
Yeah, basically that. Like, are you throwing yourself? Because, unless you're a really hungry motherfucker.
Point of order is, the people who are in charge of having smart opinions on the economy are actually really fucking stupid. And they should probably be out of a job, but what do I know? Anyway, here we are, of course, as we said, the roundup for September 2022, and there was quite a bit. Like, a decent amount scattered all over the place, various high-profile releases, some interesting, you know, in-the-know kind of stuff, and some left-field stories we weren't expecting, so... Might as well get started by, our usual recapping of what the hell actually it is that came out this past month, going week by week. So, starting September 2nd, 2022, probably getting the worst out of the way, I assume. I didn't hate myself to listen to this album. Megadeth, The Sick, The Dying, and The Dead. Which is kind of a metaphor for Dave Mustaine's whole career by this point.
I am currently The Sick, but I am not The Dying or Dead.
Anyway, there was a new Blind Guardian album, The God Machine, from mathcore band The Callous Dow Boys. We had their new album, Celebrity Therapist. From the rock band King's X, we had their new album, Three Sides of One. There was, unfortunately, a new self-titled from Youngblood. And there was a new album from the band Two Door Cinema Club with Keep on Smiling, apparently the favorite band of Suguru Geto from Jujutsu Kaisen. No, really, look it up.
Okay.
Moving into September 7th, there was a new mixtape from Young Boy Never Broke Again with Reeler 2. And then we go into the week of September 9th, where starting at the top, there was the latest album from Ozzy Osbourne with Patient Number 9. There was the newest album from the Australian band Parkway Drive with Darker Still. From the technical death metal band Revocation, we had Nether Heaven. From metalcore band Straight from the Path, we had Euthanasia. From the proggy deathcore something or other band Fallujah, we had Empyrean. From KMFDM, yeah, like that band that did that song from that anime movie like 30-something years ago. You have Hyena. From the rapper Yeet, we had his album Life, spelled with a Y. from Flogging Molly, we had Anthem, and from John Legend, we have Legend. Anyway, moving on to the week of September 16th, 2022, There was the newest album from metal band Behemoth with Opus Contra Nabu Natu. I don't fucking know. It's Latin. From The Devil Wears Prada, we have Color Decay. From the band Clutch, we have Sunrise on Slaughter Beach. We have the much-anticipated newest self-titled album from the Mars Volta, returning after a 10-year hiatus. From Death Cab for Cutie, we had their new album Asphalt Meadows. We had a new EP from Little Dragon with Opening the Door. We had a duo of albums released by rapper Ka with Languish Arts and Woeful Studies. From British-Japanese singer Rina Sawayama, we had her second full-length album Hold the Girl. And from the K-pop act Blackpink, we have Born Pink. Now, of course, in the intervening days before September 23rd, on the 21st, we had the new EP Unleash from Japanese metal band Band Maid. And unfortunately, the day after that, we had Seasons Autumn, the latest thing from that Weezer seasonal release thing. Don't ask me. I'm avoiding it like the plague. Anyway, then we go into September 23rd, 2022. Not much going on this week, but at the very least, there was the new Ken Mode album, Null. The newest album from the post-punk band Editors with EBM. From pop-punk band The Wonder Years, their newest album, The Hum Goes On Forever. And 5 Seconds of Summer with Five Sauce Five. I hate that title just on principle. Looking at it makes my eyes bleed.
Not a fan of palindromes?
Not that kind of palindrome, at least. Anyway, moving on to September 30th, the last week of the month. Very last day of the month. Convenient timing. We had the newest album from death metal band Autopsy with Morbidity Triumphant. For some reason, a new Drowning Pool album with Strike a Nerve. Dropkick Murphys with the album This Machine Still Kills Fascists. Huh. Dropkick Murphys and Flogging Molly in the same month. I think that means we get 6 more weeks of fall or something. Anyway, we had the latest album from the rock band Pixies with Doggerel. There was a Yeah Yeah Yeahs with their new album Cool It Down. Freddie Gibbs making his major label debut for Warner with Soul Sold Separately. We had a posthumous release from rapper Drakio the Ruler with Keep the Truth Alive. We had a new album from Billy Woods with Church. We had a new release from Denzel Curry, an extended cut slash reworking version of his album Melt My Eyes, See Your Future. We had another posthumous release here from Prodigy with The Hegelian Dialectic 2, The Book of Heroin. From rapper YG, we had the album I Got Issues. From Kid Cudi, we had the combined studio album and animated Netflix special Enter Galactic. Enter, not Inter.
I need to watch that.
We, of course, had the return of Bjork with her new album Fossora. And last but certainly not least, the latest studio album from the guys in Slipknot with The End So Far. So, yeah. Definitely a lot of high-profile stuff to talk about, various other releases of various types. So let's not delay things further and get things started. And as always, we throw it over to Alex to try and get the ball rolling here.
And I shall to the best of my ability, because there's a lot of stuff that came out, and I am not in a very good talking condition. But I'll try my best. I'm going to keep things relatively short this time around, even though I have 10 things here for once. I use the word things properly.
Yeah.
Okay, so first, we'll start with the latest of Dream Theater's Lost Not Forgotten Archives things. The Images and Words demos. They were released, and not much to say about them in terms of content, but I have them listed in phases. The first phase being the original instrumental demos recorded on a 4-track just in a rehearsal studio in New York while they were still between singers and recording contracts. It's a terrible thing, but one of those things that happens when you're young trying to make a break in the industry. It happens. It's cool. There's some fun banter from Mike Portnoy on Under a Glass Moon. It's a long story with that. The second phase is the vocalist audition phase, in which we have rarities. Don't Look Past Me, a deep B-side cut thing that has only been heard a handful of times on supplemental releases, with a man by the name of John Hendricks singing That Answer Live Forever, another B-side that would come up later, because they were trying to find someone who didn't sound like Jeff Tate or Geddy Lee. So they tried, and unfortunately the guys they've ended up auditioning sounded like Jeff Tate and Geddy Lee. What can you do? That didn't work. Then we have another version of To Live Forever with a man called Steve Stone, Scream For Me, Long Beach. Right now there are about 5 diehard Dream Theater fans who are getting a laugh at that. If you know, you know. And yeah, that didn't work either. Then we get Chris Collins doing a vocalist demo audition, whatever, take. Can you tell I'm sick? Of the original version of A Change of Seasons before it was reworked into the EP form. It needed to be reworked into the EP form. Yeah, that came and went. And then we get to phase 3. The entry of a new vocalist auditioning in the form of this guy from this glam band from Canada named Kevin LaBrie. You'll notice that the name changed because there was already a Kevin in the band, Kevin Moore, and there are 2 Johns in the band, so you didn't want to confuse things. Anyway, James LaBrie, he came in, he nailed it. So they tracked some demos with a producer at Bear Track Studios in Suffern, New York. The ATCO demos, that's phase 3. Basically a proof of concept of what a full album would sound like. Then they got the green lights, and that brings us to phase 4. 2-track pre-production demos. Just simple rehearsal demos with overdubbed vocals, and the rest, as they say, is history. And the album happened, and off to the races everyone went. It's an interesting listen. Not a totally necessary listen, though. But that all depends on how deep you want to get into everything here. Still good. There was also something that came out in September. A remaster of Dirt by Alice in Chains, marking 30 years since its original release. And it's been given the Dolby Atmos treatment. But everything sounds way too loud and not very well balanced.
Oh dear.
I wish people would get this right. You don't have to remake everything. All you have to do is just imagine what the album would sound like with the proper spatial audio speaker setup. It's not hard to figure out. You just got to know what part goes where. It's like a puzzle. A lot of people can't get this right, and it bothers me. The stereo version, though, it's fine enough, but a lot of feedback I've come across, like on Reddit about it, is very take it or leave it. I'm inclined to pick up, you know, the album on vinyl, but I still have, you know, the original CD, so again, take it or leave it. It's cool to have it, you know, come back around. All right, as for actual new stuff here, this new album from Rina Sawayama, Hold the Groove. Chock full of 90s and 2000s pop traits all abound, with special mention going to Stuart Price working on the production. I've always liked his work. This does take a few tracks to really find its groove. You gotta go a little bit deeper into it, like on Holy Till You Let Me Go. That's just a mood of a track right there. Along with, what was the other one? I think it was, yeah, Your Age. It's a little heavy. I like it. This album is meant to be more of a complimentary, I guess you could say, recovery album in comparison to Sawayama from 2020. It's not as in-your-face hyperpop. It's more subdued and laid back. It's finding its footing with a more balanced pop structure. I like it. I dig it. And there's another one here from John Party, Mr. Saturday Nights. He calls his style of country music neo-traditional country. It definitely shows here. It's my kind of style of country music, because I do imbibe every now and then, compared to, well, 90% of what comes out of Music Row. Nothing too special or bombastic, it's just a good time at the local bar. That's all it needs to be.
Sometimes it's all that's necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to check out more of the good country albums from this year. I think, is it Luke Bryant that Spectrum Pulse is really into, or Luke Combs? I think it's Luke Bryant. Yeah, he did a show.
I think it's Combs. Oh, because he's not a fan of Luke Bryant.
Oh, I need to get back into the country side of things. I'll figure it out once I'm of more sound mind. All right, this new King's X album, Three Sides of One. These guys have always been a bit like, what if prog rock had grunge to it? So they've been a bit of a tougher sell in comparison to bands like Dream Theater and Fate's Warning and so forth. And for their first album in 15 years, they just do more of what they're known for. And, you know, that's a good thing. It's a brisk 47 minutes, so... Yeah, I kind of had trouble trying to find something to talk about with this one. It's more King's X at the end of the day. So, you know, take it or leave it. Now, this new Mars Volta album called The Mars Volta. This was not what I was expecting. I was not expecting laid-back 70s-style jam rock. And a brisk 45 minutes at that. It's definitely a diversion compared to their more notable material, like The Last Comatorium and Francis the Mute. But again, I had trouble trying to find anything to really write home about with this. It's got a vibe to it. Maybe not my kind of vibe, but it's still a vibe. I don't know. I call this a sleeper album. I'll have to sit on that a little bit more. All right, now for this new release from Bandmade, this EP, mini album, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I was thrown off by that.
Yeah, for what it's worth, Apple Music lists it as an album, so, you know, take that however you will. I mean, it's nothing too fancy. It's just a half hour of, you know, rock and roll, and it's filled with bangers. Like From Now On and Balance. That's a great 1-2 punch to start this little mini album. It's good. Okay. Rob, I don't know how you're going to feel about what I'm about to say here, but it's... Well, here we go. Slipknot. The end so far. Something about this album felt off to me. But given the more divided reception to the album, I'm glad I'm not alone. To me, this feels less like it's Slipknot making a defining statement album, since this is their final album with Roadrunner. It feels like more of them doing a Slipknot, quote-unquote, album. What would an album sound like if it were made by Slipknot? It just feels like it's lacking something to me. Maybe it's because Jim Root didn't have as much of a hand in it, as he said in an interview. He wasn't too into doing guitar parts. I don't know. This just doesn't feel like... something's just off about this to me. I don't know what it is. I've read that they were trying to make like a heavier version of Volume 3... But to me, the comparison I would make to this is a different version of All Hope Is Gone, which to me was the peak of their lyrical and compositional maturity as they have grown to that point. Now, there's a little bit of bias to me saying that because All Hope Is Gone is my favorite album from Slipknot. But it just feels like when you take away certain... creative members, in this case, you know, the late Joey Jordison and the late Paul Gray. I don't know. It's like the Avenged Sevenfold problem with me. You take away the Rev and something's just missing. That's not, I'm not discrediting the new guys. You know, James Weinberg is great on the drums, and I'm sorry, I don't know the new bass player's name off the top of my head. I should know this. I'm sorry.
Alessandro Venturella?
Him, yeah. They're fantastic in those roles. I don't know how much they contribute creatively to a lot of the new material, but something about it, this just feels off. It feels like it's going into a different direction, which is fine. Like, the opening track, Adderall, it's very, very un-Slipknot-like. And of course, you're going to hear the usual comments, hey, did you hear the new Stone Sour album? Yeah, that was funny when you did with All Hope Is Gone, too, guys. Ha ha ha, get new material.
did you look at my notes?
I guess that's a more common thing than I thought. Okay.
We'll stick a pin in that for later, of course.
Yeah, but then you'll get more of the quote-unquote Slipknot tracks, like The Dying Song and The Chapel Town Rag and Yen. And there are tracks here that feel like, I hesitate to say this, but almost like filler, like Acidic and Warranty. I'm not going to remember these songs in the immediate future like I would tracks from All Hope Is Gone, like Gehenna and Snuff. Also, I just want to point out the closing track, Finale. This sounds like early Evanescence. It has the very early mid-2000s alternative metal gothic feel to it, with the choir and, you know, the arrangements. This feels weird. This feels very weird. It doesn't feel like, as some of the members said in the lead-up to this album, god music. This feels like... I say this because I've seen videos from Stevie T and Pete Cottrell. This is like... How would you write a Slipknot album based on what you know by Slipknot? I don't know how else to explain it. This is weird. So a lot of people like it. A lot of people aren't too hot on it. I don't know. But at the end, it just comes back to the same end result for me. When I listen to this, I could be listening to All Hope Is Gone instead. Which I do, because I actually just bought it out on vinyl a little while ago. I finally got it. Yay. I don't know what the future holds for Slipknot, considering, well, they're going to be looking for a new label home, or if they're going to go fully independent, who knows. But, yeah, this was not really the high note that it should have been. Eh, oh well. But I have two things left here that are less new releases and more new to us. Two new Evangelion soundtracks available here.
Oh, boy.
Of which there are many more still to come. First is from 2021, Evangelion Infinity, which is basically, what if Decisive Battle from the Evangelion OST was reinterpreted and referenced in various forms and tracks about 50 times over? That's the album. 50 tracks, including the notion of variations on a theme. This is for completists only. And then we get the other one, the more notable one, from 1997, Evangelion Vox. Off the bat, I can tell you this is one of the strangest albums I've ever heard. Imagine a lot of tracks with the Evangelion soundtrack being sampled and restructured into pop songs and R&B slow jams and rap.
Okay.
It sounds as weird as it actually is. Like, for instance, The Image of Me and Can't Get You Out of My Head. They're slow jams, R&B style, that lift melodies from the track from the Evangelion OST, along with Thanatos If I Can't Be Yours, a.k.a. the mid-credits song from the end of Evangelion that feels really out of place. That's the album this song was for.
Huh.
Shiro Sakisu is a strange man, but a wildly visionary creative mind. And then we get tracks like Battling, Armageddon, and Angel Attack. Rap tracks from a rap artist named Molly, who, as far as I know, there is very little information about this guy on the internet, like, anywhere. part of me especially perked up with the wonderfully clunky profanity in some of these tracks. Like in Angel Attack with the choice line, "I think you picked the wrong to fuck with."
Well,
imagine okay. that from the perspective of Shinji Ikari.
There's an image.
I'm telling you, this is weird. Like in Armageddon, that is a rap track centered around Pachelbel's canon.
Huh.
For those of you who know of the Pachelbel canon rant video on YouTube, you're probably pulling your hair out. And if you're like me and you played orchestra in middle school and high school, you're especially pulling your hair out if you know that the cello part of that song is root notes for several minutes. I had to play that track one time. It sucked.
Oh, dear.
This is such a strange album and a strange concept. But part of me is just impressed that this actually works. It's structured like a late 90s pop album. Every track leads right into the next. Also, there is, for lack of a better term, evangelist passages at the start and end of the album. Listen for yourself. It's weird. There will be tracks in the playlist. That's all I can do. I have to show you how weird this album is. Now I kind of want it to get a physical release just for the meme. Just for the meme.
Some stuff just defies a verbal explanation.
Yeah. Funny how that works, isn't it?
Now we, of course, move into the middle part of this podcast, which is always carried by good old Mark over here, who I believe has 10 as well.
Yeah, I got 10 albums as well. The funny thing, it would have been 12, except you expected me to talk about Cosley's albums. I can't, because, well, okay, as of now, I bought one of them. I ain't bought the other one yet because, things and money. What makes it so? Expect those two to be talked about next month, if I'm allowed to.
Fair enough. I'll allow it.
Yeah.
Mills Lane voice. Yeah. I'll allow it.
Yeah, and also, to the album, well, as far as I know, it's not on streaming.
Oh, it's one of those? Kind of like with Rock Marciano's albums?
Kind of, except at least, okay, well, you buy $20, but it's on a WAV file, those things. But I don't know, when it's going to be on streaming, it's been like, a month, but, either way. Anyway, I got 10 albums to talk about. Let's get the one that I've been anticipating since I've been anticipating for, and that is, of course, Freddie Gibbs, Soul Separately. Now, with this album, which I know is a major label debut since he's now on Warner Records, and part of me is kind of hesitant, maybe because see what's going to happen, what's going to change, and considering that this is basically a solo, where Freddie is, the main head of the thing, because usually when I gush about an album of his, he always got a producer, would it be Madlib or Alchemist? Now, both of them do produce a track on here, but they do produce on here, like DJ Paul, Justice League, Jake Vaughn, DJ Dahi, Eve Kitchenada on here. And I meant, like I said, I was hesitant to see if, he's trying to go a bit mainstream, mainly because that one thing he did with Moneybagg Yo too much, which was cool, but not the one I would gush over for. But going through this, like, okay, all right, it's okay. I'm like, at first I was like, okay, it's cool. Few listens in, it's like, all right, And then I was like, okay, I kind of, okay, like, I like it. I mean, I'm not going to say it's on the, like, it's on the level of a Pinata or a Bandana or Alfredo, but, okay, but I mean, but still, like, an interesting album. Like, the whole motif of the album is, like, basically Freddie is at this lovely spooky hotel, which, there's been a lot of, like, funny social media, like, a lot of, like, skits on that, I mean, on the hotel. If you're afraid of social media, which he always get, like, he gets this, like, he gets, you know, to do, Slink Johnson, you know, Black Jesus, like, in these ads, he plays a guy named Thaddeus Creef advertising the hotel, like, they got all the finest shit in here, like, all these, like, all the good eats, all that luxury shit, whatever, and then, as they go by, it's like, you get it from $1,000, I mean, from $1,000 to $400 to 80 bucks for a luxury hotel, which is like, damn, y'all want this bad? It does have some shit they've been on Adult Swim, which, well, given who you got on there, but the songs are pretty cool. Like, opening could be done. Got some, you know, basically, you know, about coming from Streets of Gary, Indiana, which you get some good vocals, some gospel like vocals from Kelly Price, which aren't a good single. Okay, Back to the Room, the second track, which is about the Alchemist, and the one thing that hit me is, okay, now I hear that elevator music I heard from Too Much, the music video. It's like, okay, it must have been from him, because that shit sounds amazing. And then the little beast, which is like, okay, like, I feel it's a bit tad too short, but all right, I still fuck with it. Like, if it's the Alchemist check I get from here, it's like, I'll take it. It's like, where'd you go? Where'd you do? Who would you screw? Black forces, so his brain will leave a stain on my shoe. This up, this go talk, maybe they put my face on a mountain, you too. Back in the room like I'm Sam Cooke at the Fontainebleau. Back in the room like I'm Sam Cooke at the Copa. Like, okay, basically, the show, like, show, I need 150,000, like I'm Ezeon. Like, you do get some tracks of like Painter Strike, which he does like it was the chorus of Bones of Time Full of Money, like with the gotta get that money, man, gotta, well, he's singing like that, but he's singing well, and it's like the song itself is cool. I will say what threw me off is he got Offset, formerly of Migos, on here, and he's not bad, but I was like, man, he's there. He's there. It's like, yeah, okay, oh, all right, it's like, it don't really fit with Offset. I don't know, maybe it's found by faith. Like, Silver Bags is, yeah, well, it's about coke. It's about coke. And got Kitchen on a beat on here, and it's like, okay, like, at first, I'm like, eh, I'm not really too high on this. A few listeners in, I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of dig it. I kind of dig it, like, again, like, there's also this other song, Lobster Omelet, which says this: on my West Coast Captain Blues, but I'm whooping them with Russ. In my neighborhood, we use a 5 or 6, had the shoes, and folks in them were stealing my starter jacket and my shoes. That, remember, I remember seeing the star logo everywhere back when I was young. Like, I think I had a notebook from them. Like, everybody knows, like, the starter logo with the S and star. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that just pops in my mind. Anyway, Rick Ross is there, and of course, Rick Ross is always on this lavish and luxurious shit, which, not surprising, because, like, he had collabed with Freddie before, you know, on a single and on Alfredo, so there's that. You got Phil Napier and Anderson Paak, and Friends Back on a hook, who has a hook on the production, and first like, okay, got some weird-ass Eastern exotic sounds, like, even transfers, like, it's kind of, so far, like, I'm kind of, like, I think it's more, like, the second half of the album gets me more than the first half, which the folks pretty are pretty good. Then you get Raekwon on the verse, which is pretty alright, which is pretty good. Also get this track of Rabbit Vision, coming from the production team, coming from Justice League, which, that's pretty fire as well, and there's also the track of PYS, which got that very hard-ass aggressive Memphis sound, mainly because it's produced by DJ Paul, which people know him from, you know, 3-6 Mafia, which, of course, you'll get that, you know, that hard-ass sound, which, all right, and there's a verse here, too, which is pretty good as well. There's also another single that they brought up but never got discussed. Dark Hearted. That's the one produced by James Blake. Which okay, that is another thing that I never expect is him work for James Blake. But then again, weird things happen. They also get like this piano and that melody vibe is something to get like something kind of dark and weird. Which of course comes from James Blake. That goes that's kind of fit. Got Gold Ring, which was like him push a T on that Coke shit again. And of course, as usual, they brought it. And hey, what do you know? A song with Freddie and Pusha T that I like that doesn't involve that one verse that I don't want to talk about.
Oh, dear. I think I remember that one, yeah.
It was a good song, too. That one line just fucking spoiled it for me.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean... Yeah, okay. Anyway, you got the Grandma Stove. Okay, so which can really be, you know, very, you know, emotional of, you know, basically his past, all that shit, basically him being more vulnerable. And okay, and of course you got a vocal from Music Soul Child, a name I ain't heard in a long time. And you got this recording, like, okay, like most of the album they do. He gets messages from is he, hey Freddie, where you at? Where you been? What you doing, man? At first you get recorded from comedian Jeff Ross for something Ross talking about what you doing, we music, and then for some odd fucking reason and maybe not, I don't know why, you get an appearance from fucking Joe Rogan of all people talking about we coming out there, wear some Kevlar underwear. Like, wait, Kevlar underwear? They make that? Who should give him the dick? Then again, that could happen.
You remember that one episode of South Park? I'm just saying.
Yeah. And then the recording is from, which I'm guessing this is Mom, which that might have some more most resonance towards it, which given that track is like, okay, yeah, they're tearing up now, like shit. Okay, anyway, we got two last tracks. Okay, we got two last tracks. Then we got CIA, which has Matlib back on the track. And again, it's gonna be like at first, I wasn't feeling it, but then going up to it's like, okay, I'm definitely with it now. Here's the lyrics in here. It's like, if this shit was my last album, then I went up to Codis. If shit was my last album, at least I rap with Otis, that being Matlib. Out to the Grammys, I wasn't expecting that, nah. So, okay. And then got decoded with Scarface. And, okay, I kind of appreciate the role of Scarface play here. Like being an OG, thinking that the OG versus are rappers for the new ones coming up, and okay, he kind of has a point about that. But yeah, like with this album, like what I worry would it be too commercial, too mainstream? Which okay, I did worry a bit, but okay, a bit. But I do feel like Wild Belgian is a bit cleaner, more sleeker, more polished. Like. It's still a good album. I just say like, it's basically like in the like, as a like as its mainstream album it is very good, but not as high as, you know, mostly his indie greats. Even though Bandana was on RCA. Anyway, this album is you know it's pretty solid. I'll give it that. Okay, and now for the other nine, and oh looky, guess what time it is?
Wait, what time is it?
It's right. The next three albums have something to do with Griselda. It's Griselda O'Clock.
Oh shit!
Yeah, because like the next three albums I'm talking about is related to that. So anyway, anyway, coming from the BSF Black Soprano family, aka the Red Click run by being the Butcher, while falling for Freddie Gibbs to being the Butcher, that's kind of awkward. We have Long Live DJ Shay. For those who don't know, DJ is a Buffalo legend. Is a legend from them. Who, well, unfortunately, he passed away. He passed away from COVID around 2020. So yeah, so they're supposed to, you know, to honor him. Which okay, to honor the legacy of him. Which okay, and of course with this, Benny got his BSF crew. The Gazelle crew came in there too, and did some shit. And I was a lot of a lot of BSF records, and the last close to I kind of just man, but this one is kind of decent. Like they do have some good words out here. They do got some good balls in here coming from the main crew. As for like, you know, most of Griselda rappers and some other features as well. Like I say, like I got people like Rick Hyde and Heem BS is pretty good. Like still get like, you know, like the singles from Thomas Fuck being the Bush, which is pretty good. Pandemic Flow with Rick Hyde, Conway, and Corey Guns, which I thought was alright. Mustachios, that's a track name. And a track called Mustachios. Mustachios with a Chase Fetty and Bodie James, I thought was pretty alright. You get some interludes from him, the DJ Shay, like he's with DJ Premier doing a thing, Senator Primo, and for the Shay with Joe Budden. Yes, that Joe Budden.
That guy's still around?
Yeah, he's still around. He's even in your room now. Okay, and for Shay, like, it's all pretty, decent standard East Coast boom, like that type of shit, which is fine. I can never miss for this. Like, I like this better than the last BSF project that I listened to and talked about. I won't say it's a on the fair, but it's pretty okay project. All right, next up, there's a new entry, Griselda. Right by the name of Rome Street.
Oh. A new challenger appears.
Which, come on, East Queens got signed to Griselda last year, and now made his debut with Kiss the Ring. Which is the album cover with a guy smiling, give you the finger with the ring on it. Which is kind of funny. Like, here's the ring, kiss the ring, as he give you the bird. Okay, anyway, the album, from what I heard, alright, on the Griselda, like, he seems pretty decent, like, I can fuck with this. The whole album is created by Westside Gunn, because, you know, that's Westside Gunn. He's basically Khaled, except better and more tolerable. After the production is kind of decent production overall. Most of it comes from Conductor Williams, which he has stuff before on Griselda shit, and it's pretty good. I will say this during the course of the album, he does this when his tech light came, it got my fucking nerves a bit. Like, for those who know Conductor Williams. Is Italian, you know, conductor, or conductor, we have a problem. Like, okay, dude, you can shut up with that shit now. You gotta say it every fucking 4 minutes. I know it's a Conductor Williams track. Shit.
Wait, that can't seriously be his DJ tag, right? Or like his producer tag, or.
Yeah, that's what he said. Like, conductor, we have a problem. So, conductor, we have a problem. That's the. That's the tagline. It's either that or conductor. Like, basically is basically that. Like at least the first one was cool. Like you just say conductor, but the other one was like, you say that all the time. I was like, okay, you can stop with that shit now.
You know, that might be the weirdest producer tag I've heard in a while. Like, I feel like if this goes on for long enough, we're gonna get a producer whose tag is basically just the entire script of B Movie. Like just running underneath the entire song.
Damn. All right. But still, we got production from Kevin Florence Monk. Let's see, Derringer as well. Derringer is his boy. Danny LaFleur. It sounds like a wrestler's name. Maybe I don't know. A Green Lantern. Of course, the Alchemist on one track. It's Sadu. I'm trying to read it. I don't think the name's clear, but yeah. I say like again. One of these are pretty good. Like you know, like very similar, like Griselda shit. Griselda, like you do get tracks that name after like Beatles legends. Like you get one track called Soldier Boy, which features Conway, which goes Conway does kill it on the living on the bars. You got one track called Tyson Beckford. Destiny Child, which okay. There's one track In Too Deep where at the end of the song they have a sample of the Sonic Drowning music near the end. Like, okay, where did that shit come from? they got the sample of the Sonic Drowning, like the music you hear when Sonic is underwater and he's drowning, like we know the one that sound. That's kind of interesting. All right. I wasn't a I do like. Soulja Boy is pretty good. Tyson Beckford's all right. I like Armin Dangerous with Amaya Caesar, which I think she was great in that. And I love the last track, Fashion Rebel. Well, second last track, Fashion Rebel, which just got this rhythm that kind of stuck with me a lot. I mean, and of course, you got serving with Boldy James, which is pretty good. Now, in fact, the West Side Gun is all right. Like these songs are pretty good. I will say, my problem with one part of that, they do kind of feel too long. It's like 17 tracks, 50 minutes. You could have cut a few tracks off, like maybe three or so, but. Yeah, so, but, okay, interesting to know about, you know, a new rapper on the Griselda, and, alright, I'm looking forward to see what more he has in store for me. Alright, and the last Griselda affiliated person on here, Boldy James, and this time collaborated with, Nicholas Craven, which album title, Fair Exchange, No Robbery. Look at the album cover, which looks like something you see on some old newspapers, like something on a newspaper or a coffee mug, which just looked like a drawing, you'll see it if you edit the shit. This track album, I ain't calling it EP, it's 36 minutes, it's a fucking album, alright? It's like, all right, like, you do got the usual storytelling of his, you know, of the Detroit Jug game, which, you know, basically what boy knows best, and once again, this shit is pretty good. It's pretty good. Y'all know I love listening to shit like this. I love listening to stuff about this shit. I mean, listening to Nicholas Craven's production, which, okay, I'm beginning to like him more and more. Like, I really like a whole lot of these producers, a whole lot of these underground hip-hop producers that do shit for a lot of underground, you know, rappers that are basically around the East Coast shit, or, you know, just, you know, those in the know. But yeah, this album got some decent cuts. Like, Town of Country was pretty good. Monterey Jack, which, okay. I love the beat on Designer Drugs, which has this 80s saxophone loop, which I just love hearing that saxophone loop here and again. Like, damn, this is just fucking hit. I'm definitely, this is one of my favorite tracks on there. Like, maybe intense in there. But yeah, like I gotta say, but this album, like, all right, pretty decent, pretty decent. And may I remind you, like this Rome Streets, and Freddie Gibbs, and you know, that's it. Those came out the same day. So there's like a lot of releases around the 30th, which is like, yeah, it was a packed day. All right, and okay, the next one, Prodigy, the Hegelian Dialect to the Book of Heroin. I hope I said that right.
I mean, I wouldn't entirely sure. I don't even know what a Hegelian dialectic is. Kind of sounds like something you hear in like a 3-hour long video essay about why Fallout New Vegas is the greatest game ever made. You know, those kinds of videos.
Okay, yeah. So you don't know, it is a post-mortem album from Prodigy, who as you know passed away 2017, and this is 2017, and this is like the second part of a 10 trilogy, which his estate is part of the final one. Like, I don't know who's gonna release, but I guess they're just working the kinks of it. And well, like most pop albums, it does like some songs stitched together from our tracks, like a Frankenstein album. But I wouldn't say it's not trying to it's bad or they're trying to milk it dry. They're just trying to take care of this shit, like try to make sure they do it right or at least do as best they can. But okay, like a Prodigy album, I will say like it is like a Prodigy album. I'll say not my favorite, but there is some shit. There is some shit that I do kind of you know get with like, okay, walk off with DJ Premier, that was pretty good. You'd have won it with him, Big Daddy King, and DJ Scratch. All right, you go check with him and Remy Ma with Overdose. Well, Overdose, Dope was pretty good. Angel Faith Evans, which is all right. Like, this track's that does feel a slight bit of polish, but not all the way. But it's like the album is okay. Like all respect to Project Ray, rest in peace. He's still got his ping game of, you know, do a lot of street tales for, you know, that are really, you know, very brutally honest with vivid descriptions and, you know, barely doing that vulnerable shit. But I'll say this album, it's again, this album is fine. I probably won't, it might not make it to the best of the list, but I'll say it's worth checking out if you miss Project and you want to hear more of him. That's what I'm saying. All right. Okay, next you are going to be short as fuck because I didn't have much to say about these next five. So here we go. There was a Cameron album last month. You know Cameron, Dipset rapper, that guy.
Name sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Him and A-Track got a project which apparently was shelved for a long time, which is called He Wasn't There. Which, okay. Does feel like something you would hear from, like, I could tell it was a show from a few years, and I remember a lot of Dipset back in the day, especially a lot of Cameron, maybe Jim Jones, the rapper, not the other guy. Not so much Jewel Santana, I don't know, I just, I don't know.
Wait, that name sounds familiar. Was that the motherfucker on that one Chris Brown song from 2004?
Yes, that was him.
Oh my fucking god.
Like I said, like my motherfuckers more. But anyway, on this album, I can tell this definitely was an album that was shelved for a few years. I mean, that was feel like something you would hear from, like, I don't know, like maybe 2017 or something. But is it? I guess it's there. I mean, you got some more right tracks. You got Ghetto Prophets with him and Calling the Machine. You get some skits with Damon Dash. Remember him as well? You know, dude who used to run, I don't know, Rockefeller, that old motherfucker that, I don't know, I guess, yeah, that, yeah, before Jay-Z left and become his own, him become the big man that he is now. No way. And I'll say, like this album is like, okay, all right, it's 9 tracks, 27 minutes, which is like, okay, that could be EP or something. I don't know. I'll say this album is fine. It's all right. I've seen it a lot. But that's all I got for this. Let's see. This Little Dragon EP, opening the door, which is just the three fucking songs on here, which, all right, they're all good, they're all pretty breezy, they all got that central Little Dragon style, which was pretty good. Stayed with Jid, pretty good. The other songs, Frisco, good. Peace, good. That's it. That's what, like, 12, 13 minutes. There you go. That's the review. Okay. Next one. I listened to that new Editors album, EBM. This is gonna be really short because again, I say it was like okay, like if you want some eighties type of post punk type of shit, which is the one I listen to recall a lot, but I could definitely get lost in the music. It's like, alright, it's pretty decent. I could definitely get with this. Okay, Reina Samyama, Hold the Girl. I'll say this, like, there is a less bit of that experimental flavor I got from the last album, and more that dance pop 90s type of shit here than the industrial shit I got, which I'm not gonna cut out. Like, it's still a good album, which it is more heartfelt and personal, talking about with issues with everything and all, which I can get with that. Like, it's still an album. I'll say I like the first one better. It's like with me and Billy Eilish. Like, I like the first album better than the second one, but I'm not gonna trash the second one. It's still a good record. That's all I'm gonna say to that. And the last one, y'all not gonna believe what I turn into. The Mars Volta, self-titled.
Oh.
I guess this is basically me going in blind because, this is my first time listening to him. Like, I know you're thinking, why the hell would you listen to such type of album, even though they got years of albums before that? I don't know. Maybe something interesting is drawing me, so I was talking this one. I want to say, is this more Latin rock, psychedelic, progressive pop rock, ambient type of shit? I don't know what to call it, but I can definitely listen to it. It's kind of my vibe. This is kind of my vibe. Maybe I know there'd be some better shit in the catalog. That's something I might do in the future because I'm kind of lazy when it comes to looking back at albums and shit. Now I'm really saying this, but yeah, I say I'm kind of fucking with this. Like, I get like again like it's like this type of rock or whatever the fuck it is. It's kind of my shit. And there you go. Yeah, that's it.
All right, we got that much out of the way. So first we had 10, then we had another 10, and for me we have, that's right, 12. I go two beyond. I got a whole dozen here. You know, like a dozen donuts or cookies or something. I'm not sure where I'm going with this metaphor. So yeah, I might as well start, as I do always, with my unambiguous top picks for the month. First up, I remember a few years back when a man on the internets by the name of Thompson, Crash, brought up the existence of a band called The Callous Dowboys in one of his videos. I believe it was in 2019, they had an album called Die on Mars. I checked it out, it was really good. And now, here we are 3 years later with the follow-up, Celebrity Therapist. and it wastes no time getting started, like, hitting you in the face right away with the album opener, Violent Astrology, whopping you in the face with loud booming production, frantic-ass guitars drenched in, like, very squealing leads and underscored by a lot of wild drum rhythms, whacked-out screaming vocals. It is everything you want out of, like, some primo mathcore, seating themselves among, like, a lot of the recent greats of the genre, like, you know, your Car Bombs or your Frontierers, and, of course, trying to fill in the void left behind by the absence of Dillinger. They're doing a good job of it so far, but I definitely do think that while it hits you with a lot of what you would expect from that genre, you know, like, you get songs like Field Sobriety Practice, which has a lot of these, like, again, those Frontier-style explosions of chords and very squealing dissonant leads, or a brief article regarding time loops with some real saturated metalcore chugs, deep growling in there that makes for some really, like, amped up mosh fodder with some triplet grooves in there. Yeah, you get a lot of that intensity, but I definitely think Callous Dalboys find a way to set themselves apart mainly through their vocals and lyrics, because the lyrics on these on their songs tend to be, like, very verbose to the point of almost kind of being reminiscent of, like, I kind of want to say, like, it reminds me of, like, how pop punk and emo tend to be very detailed with their lyrics, but also there tends to be quite a bit of sarcasm here and there. Like, that album opener, the lyrics are basically sarcastic as fuck, taking several jabs at, you guessed it, generic Facebook and Twitter conservative tough guys. You know the ones. As it says in the lyrics, your Punisher skull on your Ford and Facebook wall. Everything you share is to reinforce your worldview. No one will muzzle you like I will with my own bare hands. The type of people who have opinions about black actors getting cast in Marvel and Star Wars movies. Recorded from their shitty pickup truck with their sunglasses. God, I can feel the acid reflux in my throat just thinking about it. But then, of course, you get songs that are, like, you know, generally more sort of emotive in a sense, like title track. Not the title track, it's a song literally called title track. It has a lot of clean guitars, droning synths, and this very melancholic vibe to it that feels kind of like in the vein of the more, like, emotional kind of Dillinger songs. Of course, to then be contrasted by, like, random bursts of mathcore energy. And then you get, like, Field Sobriety Practice. It's definitely very emotional as the narrator's dealing with a lot of tormented memories of someone they used to know and care about. There's a track like Beautiful Dude Missile, which I think is supposed to be a penis joke. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me, at least. Which, you know, brings in a lot of aggressive, rapid, syncopated, pounding, snare, and kicks, not unlike, again, Frontier, with a lot of heavy bass in there as the song kind of settles into this 4-4 passage with these blaring horns and clean guitars that honestly kind of feels like a metal version of Black Midi, like where their last couple albums were. Yeah, if my notes sound a bit all over the place, that's because this is the kind of band that's, like, all over the place. In the best way, of course. That three albums in, they're definitely earning their place among, like, the greats of the mathcore genre, while still forging their own, like, distinct feeling in the scene. If you've been sleeping on them, I recommend not doing that anymore. Just get on this shit. Do it now. Well, okay, not, like, right now. Finish listening to this, then now. Anyway, next album recommendation. So, the guys in Ken Mode have been really productive, apparently, in recent years, at least according to the Apple Music listing for their new album, Null. Apparently, for the writing sessions, they came up with so many songs together that they wound up with basically two albums, because they didn't really want to discard it, because they was like, man, this shit is good. So, yeah, we have the first of these, Null, and in the near future, we're getting a follow-up titled, come on, any guesses? What are they going to call?
Void.
Hey, Mark gets it.
Okay, damn, that was a guess, but like,
listen, I wouldn't have asked if it wasn't obvious. Null, Void, So, yeah, most notable about this particular album is the addition of a new full-time member, Catherine Kerr, who's credited with some backing vocals, pianos and synths, and, wait for it, everybody get your liquor, prepare to take a shot. Saxophones!
Ah, it's back!
Ken Mode's got sax now, baby! Seriously, we need, like, a drinking game for, like, how many rock and metal bands just start throwing sax in there. I could have emptied out my bottle of Suntory by now. And it pretty much sounds exactly how you would expect. Like, you get the album opener, A Love Letter, which has this steady pounding groove, bringing the heaviness through these aggressive guitar chugs, these ominous buzzing chords. Of course, the sax and synths adding whole new layers of intensity and menace to everything. Sounding very atonal, like it's getting, like it's almost getting choked out, or like they're borrowing it from, like, an Imperial Triumphant song. Very good. Then, of course, we get the one single that we were able to talk about before the album release, Throw Your Phone in the River, where the complex cymbal patterns and twangy-as-hell guitar rhythms create a fitting soundscape for vocalist Jesse Mathewson to scream at everyone about how we need to fuck off with the doom scrolling. Still a very relatable sentiment. That righteous, like, furious energy carries through the album like always, mixing a lot of that, having that very specific mix of, like, twangy, noisy guitars with also a lot of overdrive, these very dense and aggro drum performances, like on the track But They Respect My Tactics, for example. And while this album is a very succinct affair, it's 8 tracks, 35 minutes, just shy of a third of that is dedicated to one single song, that being the track Lost Grip, which runs at a whole 10 minutes. It's easily one of the more downbeat and melancholic tracks in the Ken Mode discography. The drums sort of groove along very slowly, building and building, with the bass playing the simple, like, steady four-note rhythm, droning on alongside with the guitars and these melancholic piano notes in the background, eventually swelling into a very, like, typical Ken Mode heaviness, maintaining that slower tempo. Fittingly enough, the lyrics are very morose as Jesse screams about, you know, the obsession with wealth and power, how those at the top of the social hierarchy will always seek to attain these at the expense of the well-being of guys like us down here in the trenches. Mainly repeatedly emphasizing lyrics like, we deserve this, and I don't believe that you mean well, as well as everything else he's singing in there, and yeah, it certainly makes for, like, a really good highlight amidst this record, and a very, very, you know, solid part one, I guess if you want to call it that. We'll see what exactly they have saved for whenever Void happens. Now, moving on to the next album here, which is, the new Editors, EBM, something that just kind of ended up on our radars by tangential coincidence, mainly because an artist that we normally talk about, Blank Mass, has apparently been involved with the band since 2018 to the point of being promoted as a full-time member. As a matter of fact, if you're wondering what that album title even means, it's an acronym for Editors Blank Mass.
Wait, that's what that meant?
Apparently, yeah.
Okay, just shut this back. Hey, look, it's all me. I'm Blank Mass. It's me with y'all.
I mean, I'm not sure what else it could stand for, and that makes sense to me. So, yeah, I delved through the band's back catalog beforehand, and, okay, for one, apparently they were once on the soundtrack to a Twilight movie. That's how long they've been around. Take that as you will. But, more serious for a moment, there's kind of this, like, sort of gradient that they sometimes slide around on between sort of full-on guitar-driven post-punk and some more, like, moody synth pop, but with the addition of Benjamin John Powers here, the synthetic elements have a firmer grasp, and you hear this from the jump on the album opener Heart Attack, with these super bouncy electronics, you know, accentuated by the grooves of the drum and bass and these stuttering synth melodies. It has, like, a really fun energy to it, especially when the guitars finally chime in particular during that last minute and a half, which slaps pretty hard. And then it just keeps slapping even more when we get the second song, Picturesque, where Blank Mass's production style definitely shines in a lot more, especially when you're hearing that very squealy kind of, like, if you listen to Blank Mass, you know that his production has a fondness for, like, very glitchy vocal samples as a recurring motif, and you get that, like, kind of squealiness in the background of this very, like, high-energy kind of 80s new wave post-punk dance track. It's got a really banger energy to it, and I think I could say this is, like, the one track that I listen to the most off this album. It's just stupidly catchy as hell. Then, of course, we get Karma Climb, which brings a lot of stuttering rave synths and synthetic drum textures into a song that's definitely very heavily driven by syncopated bass and just, again, equally energy, but in that very 80s dance sort of way. I would say, like, the epicenter of this vibe being the single Kiss, which almost kind of sounds like it could be, like, this could be a soundtrack piece to a John Hughes movie or something. It just kind of has, like, that particular vibe to it. Yeah, like I said, Blank Mass's production, it does a lot to really add something new to Blank Mass's style that definitely amps up what could have been just a regular post-punk album. Because there's been, you know, quite a bit of that here and there. Especially, like, in recent years with stuff like Ice Age and Fontaine's DC. Like, this has its own identity. And one of the most perfect songs in that regard would be Strawberry Lemonade, that finds the most, this really great, like, middle ground perfect balance between their post-punk side and the kind of dancey synth-pop new wave that they're going for, with very unmistakably, like, Blank Mass glitchy electronics. I think this is probably going to wind up somewhere on my year-end list, and if nothing else, it's definitely the most pleasant surprise I've heard all year. Like, I wasn't expecting this to, like, hit me as much as it did, but this is, chef's kiss, Saint Magnifique, or whatever they say in France. Now, I'm going to talk about one more top pick here. There's another album I sort of have categorized here, but with the notes I took on that, I'll probably save that for the end. But my last unambiguous top pick will, of course, be The Wonder Years, The Hum Goes On Forever. Pretty interesting that these guys have been still kicking around since their formation in 2005. Their first couple albums were, like, solid enough, but then once they hit their third album, that's when they really, like, just kicked it up into the upper echelon of the genre. Like, I seriously mean it when I say that 2011's Suburbia, I've Given You All and Now I'm Nothing is in the top five for best pop-punk albums of the 2010s, if not the best. It is everything that the genre should be and more, with just fantastic catchy instrumentation, really compelling emotional lyrics, and just great vocals all around. It is as close to perfect as the genre can get. And of course, from there, they've grown quite a lot in the albums they've been releasing in the interim, with their last studio album being 2018's Sister Cities. And of course, quite a lot happened in the interim since then, most significantly, well, okay, there was that whole fucking COVID-19 thing, but aside from that, most relevant here, frontman Dan Campbell had two kids in that time. Means he's a whole ass dad now, adding a new source of inspiration for all kinds of, you know, emotional angst and just questioning of the world and what you're doing in it. And fittingly enough, that theme of fatherhood and just kind of growing into adulthood in general, keep in mind this guy's like a few years away from being 40, that informs the bulk of the lyrics on The Hum Goes On Forever. The album opener, Doors I Painted Shut, sets the stage with this very slow, steady build-up to the soaring chorus as he sings about struggling with self-doubt and his own desires to kind of want to just, like, run whenever life feels like it's going to back him into a corner. Just the general feeling of uncertainty as life hits you with new experiences and challenges. Then the following track, Wyatt's Song, parentheses, Your Name, no relation to the movie, is a pretty typical, you know, Wonder Years jam, I'd say, with very solid riffs, a super catchy chorus, and really fantastic melodies as Dan sings about, well, his son Wyatt, and wanting to be a good father, someone who can be there for him and protect him from things like the depressing state of the world, or even, like, some broken glass in the yard or something. Things like that. The theme of struggle and seemingly helpless situations pops up a lot in songs like Cardinals 2, which follows up the song of the same name from their album No Closer to Heaven, narrating his despair over this recurring nightmare he has about not being able to save a childhood friend from a terrible fate, eventually swelling in this kind of loud bridge that's just very saturated in guitar chugs. And I'd say the album is probably at its most morose on the track fittingly titled Songs About Death, which is damn near emo in how it constructs itself, especially lyrically, as it's just like 10 lines total about how kind of fucked it is that Campbell, through his career, has written so many songs about, like, death or loss. Feeling that pain even further whenever these are songs that he performs to a crowd at Wonder Years shows, and the crowd is, of course, singing back, noting how, like, strange it is and how depressing it is and how he wishes that all this could just, like, all this pain could just stop even for just a moment. I'd probably say the most fitting comparison in that regard would be a band that I feel like a recent band that has taken heavy influence from the Wonder Years in several respects to the point where the two have actually toured in recent years, Spanish Love Songs. Although maybe not that bleak, I feel like the Wonder Years still kind of have like this vague light at the end of the tunnel mindset, even for as depressing as their material can be. Hell, contrasting a lot of those depressing vibes, Summer Clothes is a more acoustic-focused tune about simpler times when your sadness didn't get in the way of being able to live life, you know, being youthful and ridiculous, not worrying about that sad shit. And even through all that maturity, we still get more of that, like, spirited, youthful Wonder Years energy, like, on Lost It in the Lights, or The Paris of Nowhere, the latter being an energetic pop-punk banger that fulfills the mandatory Wonder Years quota of writing a song that's basically a bunch of references to the history/geography of Pennsylvania and the Northeast. I forget where exactly they're from, but I know normally they make a lot of references to Philadelphia in specific. In particular, you'll get lyric drops to references like the Kensington Junkyard Fire of 2018, the Delaware River and its state of pollution during World War II, Market East Station, now known as Jefferson Station, and of course the most cherished of Philadelphia icons, former Eagles quarterback/MVP Nick Foles, who led the team to their first ever Super Bowl win in 2018. I say former because he apparently defected to the Colts in the intervening years.
He is a bit of a, permanent backup, we'll just say.
Conveniently, the song skips over the whole Colts part. But, yeah, for a band that's still going, like, a good, like, 17-ish years strong, they're still as great as they've ever been. Being able to hit you right there in the emotional sweet spot, really fantastic emotionally honest lyrics, and just really catchy instrumentation all around. Now we are going to move into part two here, which is the quick round of stuff. Stuff that I don't have a lot to say about, so we can move through this pretty quickly. Ozzy Osbourne, Patient Number 9. My opinion here is a retread of my thoughts on Ordinary Man, i.e. on a songwriting level, just purely looking at the songs. This album is solid. There are some good jams on here, like God Only Knows, which kind of brings like this very 90s Ozzy heaviness combined with his more ballady tendencies, or even No Escape From Now, one of the tracks that has Tony Iommi making an appearance on an Ozzy solo album for the first time in ever. But once again, the goddamn production and all the fucking sonic compression kills the experience and just makes me want to, like, not go back to it all that much. Like, seriously, there's got to be someone out there with, like, you know, early recordings that can do, like, a better mix of this. Please? Ozzy, look, if you're somehow going to record another album while you're still in this mortal coil, can you work with a different producer, please? I don't want to have to keep making these qualifications. Come on. Rina Sawayama with Hold the Girl. Solid. Solid. Solid a pop record as you could hear this year. I liked it. If you desire those kind of like alternative and pop rock vibes of like the 90s and 2000s, you got it. You want catchy pop rock? This hell has you covered. You want acoustic electronic R&B? The title track is a bop. Need some great soaring anthemic jams? Catch Me in the Air will have you soaring in the air. You want something with a bit more of an attitude? Your Age goes pretty goddamn hard. Two for two. Anyway, the Mars Volta, self-titled. As the person here that had to do required listening homework, courtesy of Alex here, I will say that this is definitely not what I was expecting either. Like, for all the complex, abstract progginess of their earlier efforts, you know, fusing that with their more hardcore tendencies from their At the Drive-In stage, this is more streamlined than most. And according to various interview statements from the band, apparently that's by design. Like, they wanted this to be a more direct and less abstract album in both music and even lyrics than their previous output. Hell, weird tangent. Apparently when writing this album, the guys would, like, physically mail, like, their recordings on, like, I think, like, either hard drives or, like, USB sticks to each other, because apparently a lot of this album calls out abuse scandals related to the Church of Scientology in general, and very specifically, the jackass who played Hyde on that 70s show, who was involved in, like, emotionally and sexually abusing one of the band members' wives. Class act. Yeah, so that obviously was, you know, well, I mean, it certainly was an effective way to sneak under the church's radar, I guess. And yeah, instrumentally, it leans way more into post-rock and Latin jazz while keeping songs at a concise length overall. I'm still feeling out how I feel about this one. Bandmade with Unleash. So, I just want to point out, we recently got, like, the announcement of a new Baby Metal album coming sometime down the road. And in the meantime, this album definitely, like, fills what feels like the long hole in between. Although, calling them akin to Baby Metal feels a bit, like, misleading in a way, because this is definitely more, like, overtly straight-up metal than metal J-pop hybridization, like, you know, Baby Metal or even Lady Baby. Don't ask. There's a lot of those bands out there. This one definitely brings it, though. It really works with the big thrashy riffs, a lot of booming drums, meaty grooves, shredding all over the place. Not to mention the only salvageable aspect of Platinum End being, you know, the song Sense. Anyway, last but not least of the quick round, Bjork with Fossora. While her previous full-length, Utopia in 2017, was this very lush, beautiful folktronica album, driven heavily by flute arrangements and the lush experimental electronic production of Arca, this one definitely has its more unnerving side to it. Being heavily devoted to motifs of mushrooms and fungi, as well as at least partly being inspired by the death of Bjork's mother in 2018, there is a whole lot of bass clarinet on this one, and more distorted electronics, as well as more complicated vocal arrangements that all unite to create this very, unnerving atmosphere. Like the mushrooms are gonna come to life and fucking eat your corpse or something. Have fun living with that nightmare, kids. Anyway, that gets rid of the quick round, so now we have the two lowlights for me for this month that I think can both be filed under the same general reaction of, what the hell are you guys even still doing here? Y'all peaked a decade ago. What? Why are you still making music? First up, the Aussies are on the table. Parkway Drive, who peaked in 2010 with Deep Blue, their third album. We are now on their seventh album, Darker Still. And they haven't released anything worth a damn since then in 2010. And it just sounds like them trying to graft whatever remains of their metalcore roots onto some really boring, like, hard rock mellow death nonsense. Like, take their old style, throw it in a blender with some Ghost, some post-grunge, a Monomarth, and some H2O as well, which isn't a band name, but I just needed to tell you how watered down this sounds. The riffs and drums are super basic, the attempts at soaring melodies are just really nondescript. Like, seriously, in a year where we got a new Soilwork album, bringing some of the finest melody writing you'll hear in metal this year, this shit is just nothing. Except for, you know, when it tries for, you know, a ballad, like with a title track that just, again, does nothing. It's like flat soda or a table lamp, just something tasteless that exists. And for some fucking reason, Winston McCall's vocals on here are super annoying. And it's not just because of the really lame quality of a lot of the lyrics. Like, I want to point out, there's a song here called Glitch where the opening line is, "Feel a glitch in the cortex, like a ghost in the shell." This is the second worst thing to ever happen to the Ghost in the Shell branding. Okay, actually third worst, because there's this, Gitsack underscore 2045, and Scarlett Johansson. And he also, but aside from that, he also has these weird vocal quirks that he does on here, like the song If a God Can Bleed has this supremely cringy spoken word grumbling, like, I don't get what he's doing here. Like is he trying to narrate some old fairy tale or something? It's not working. or the old school nu metal kind of rapid fire vocals on songs like Soul Bleach. Wait, Ghost in the Shell, Soul Bleach. That is the most amusement I got out of this album. Noticing random things that may or may not be anime references. And then, of course, there is The Devil Wears Prada with Colored Decay, which is, I guess, a bit more listenable. It's not as annoying as Darker Still, but I'm still not entirely sure why this band is still around. Like, okay, there are okay songs on here. Like, the album opener Exhibition has a solid enough energy and tempo to it. Even if the harsher vocals from Mike Kranica feel very strained and the choruses, well, this is another symptom of the Imagine Dragon. Oh, and if that sends shivers down your spine, well, yeah, they still have the single Salt on here, which exists to pour sodium chloride into the wounds. I'm sorry, I had to say sodium chloride. The joke was too easy, and I don't think it was worth the effort. It's got even more of that, like, clean, flavorless synth-pop tinge, which doesn't stop when you have to deal with way too poppy verses and choruses on tracks like Broken, Time, and Trapped, proving that the plague of that dragon is still going strong. But to be fair, there is still a bit of an energy here on tracks like Noise and Watchtower that I can give a pass, but so much of this album still feels like very been there, done that. There's just not anything new here. Again, it's kind of like flat soda. Alright, so we did the top picks, we have the quick round, we have the lowlights, but now there's the one other pin that we have to return to, and I can only file this under question marks, which is strange because, again, this is my favorite band. So here we are with Slipknot's final album for Roadrunner Records, The End So Far. Or The End For Now, if the misprintings on the vinyl are meant to be believed. Man, you really think someone would have communicated that better, but yeah, so the path to this album, at least this era generally for Slipknot, has been a bit of a strange one. The post All Hope Is Gone years, which sometimes, depending on my mood, my favorite Slipknot album is either that or Iowa. So I'm at least partially with Alex there, at least. But yeah, ever since, like, the years following that album with the untimely passing of Paul Gray, the dismissal and then passing of Joey Jordison, and then Chris Fenn getting the boot due to legal bullshit, it's been a very messy time. But, like, at the very least, like, the album still kind of held together. Like, I still very clearly remember We Are Not Your Kind being my number one album of that year. But it kind of feels like there's just been so much messiness surrounding this one. Like, again, with the legal bullshit, with Jim Root not getting as much creative input, the end of their tenure with Roadrunner. It kind of seemed like there was a lot. Oh, don't forget about the fucking Machine Gun Kelly beef. That was the thing. So, I'm not quite sure how to talk about this. This is the most notes I have of any album I listened to this month, so I'm going to try and talk about what I like about it first, just so I can be, like, clear and focused and, you know, direct about some things. So, I'll admit, I do like the album opener, Adderall. It's certainly a very unique opener with its very moody, slow and steady tempo, using a lot of clean lead vocals and backing choir vocals. That bass groove combined with the strange synthetic twinge in the background, I think it works. Slipknot albums usually open on kind of like a moodier note anyway, so having this be a more fleshed out song is fitting. Then immediately after that, we swerve into the expected, you know, Slipknot heaviness, where we get the 1-2 punch of The Dying Song, Time to Sing, and The Chapeltown Rag. Of course, Dying Song still goes pretty hard with Jay Weinberg's excellent drums providing plenty of groove amidst all sort of like the thrash and bash of it all. The guitars still sound pretty good, and Corey screaming his head off all gnarly as hell. There's even a really great bass lick in there that stands out from Alessandro. Chapeltown Rag, I think, probably winds up the best song on the album. And this is the one that was like released before there was even an announcement proper. It still evokes the full force heaviness of the Iowa era, as every part of the band like gets to stick out in their own ways, even like the backing auxiliary percussion booming alongside the main kit, the DJ scratches from Sid Wilson popping in and out, plenty of heavy aggressive riffs and grooves segueing into ear-piercing tremolos and blast beats. It is unambiguously peak Slipknot, in my opinion. Of course, we get another pretty solid banger later on with the track H377, with a lot of hard chugging guitars and Corey delivering a lot of rapid fire vocals. Let's see. I think one of the more unique tracks on the album is Medicine for the Dead. Like this is Slipknot getting into their moodier side of things. Like, it's got this slow but heavy syncopated rhythm for its pre-verses, a lot of eerie melodies for the verse and chorus, letting a lot of the cymbal work and backing percussion permeate that clean space. I think it works. Like it might not be on the same level as, like, what for me is the best of that kind of Slipknot song, which is Gehenna, but I still like it. And then, of course, similarly, we get the track Desaad, which, if you're wondering, I believe that's a reference to the infamous 18th century French philosopher and writer, the Marquis de Sade, whose writings were known for being aggressively and violently horny as fuck, so much that they are credited with the origin of what we know as sadism in sexuality. It has this very downbeat moodiness conveyed through Corey's vocals and the song's overall melodic construction, with some underlying tom grooves, as it definitely tries to go out with a bang. Which leads into, you know, the somber closer, fittingly called Finale, which is this very downbeat, mid-tempo closer that brings back a lot of the choir vocals. And when it comes to sort of Slipknot songs that are more emotional and melodramatic, I kind of like when they sound more like this, as opposed to something like, say, the single that we got, Yen. I don't know, something about that chorus just doesn't fully work for me. It's just a me thing. Like, there are some eerie somberness, you know, in that song, but, you know, sort of akin to, like, Snuff or Dead Memories, especially when that toy box melody comes in, but I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, this is where we're kind of getting into stuff where I think I feel more mixed about. Like, Warranty instrumentally feels a lot like it's pulling from the Volume 3 All Hope Is Gone era, in particular utilizing a lot of palm-muted guitars, emphasizing the grooves, and again, you get more of the choir vocal on the bridge, but the lyrics are a bit weird. Maybe because it takes the Warranty motif a bit too literal. I'm not exactly sure how you take a lyric like, you always buy brand new, and try to make it heavy. If it's a metaphor for something, I'm not sure what it is. Then you get, like, there are a few tracks on here that I don't care for. Like, Acidic and Heirloom, which, yeah, this is where I made the joke about Alex peering at my notes, because I marked Heirloom and also Yen as well as the requisite Slipknot turns into Stone Sour for a couple tracks, songs on here. And that's something they've kind of been doing since at least All Hope Is Gone, and their track record on that is super mixed. But there are, how do I put this, like, if I wanted to listen to Stone Sour, I'd listen to Stone Sour, and I don't listen to a lot of Stone Sour for a reason. They just don't do much for me, I'm sorry. But yeah, I mean, there's more good tracks on here than tracks I dislike, but what I was saying about the band kind of being in a very messy place with, you know, the Machine Gun Kelly beef, losing yet another member, now down to like 2/3 of their original lineup, and, you know, their departure of their label, you definitely feel a lot of that messiness in the way this album is kind of written. And I don't know if this is where Alex was going with it, because the way you were describing it almost kind of makes it sound like there's a Flanderization of Slipknot going on here. Like, you know how Flanders used to be a character with a lot of nuance before he kind of turned into, like, this one-note caricature of himself? I don't know, but yeah, this feels like Slipknot impersonating Slipknot at points, and again, I just really don't know where I'm supposed to lie on this, because there are more good songs on here than bad songs, but big picture-wise, it's still not quite crystallizing for me. Like, Let me put it like this. Of the last three Slipknot albums, We Are Not Your Kind is still the best. Like, for me, that's kind of unambiguously where they peaked in this era. I'm not sure where this weighs against 0.5 The Great Chapter, because for a while I kind of thought that was, like, my least favorite Slipknot album, but I'd have to go back and listen to that one. Yeah, I didn't check out the reception beforehand, but I wouldn't really blame anyone for the divided reception on this one, because, yeah, it sounds like something wasn't quite clicking here. That's why I call it question marks. Just question marks all around. I guess we'll really know come year-end list time, but for now, we'll just leave it at there are some really, really good songs on here. And I guess if you just go to those and ignore the weirder ones, you'll probably have a solid time overall. Yeah, definitely a weird way to end out on. Maybe the next one will be more, I guess, coherent, I suppose. Anyway. Yeah, that's my last big spiel for my section of the roundup. Of course, if any of these albums intrigue you, again, as always, the playlist will be linked down there in the description. And yeah, we'll of course be back next month with the next roundup for October, and I think that'll probably be the last album roundup we end up doing before we eventually buckle down for year-end list of season. Of course, be sure to visit all our socials, you know, Twitter at SurrealRezzo, SurrealResolution.com. Jump from there to our Discord, where you can, I don't know, scream at us for music opinions, and I will promptly not give a shit. Or you can probably just talk about, like, other stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be yelling at us for music, because we also talk video games, or lost media. Did you see that Kingdom Hearts TV pilot? That was a thing that happened. But, yeah, be sure to tune into that, and of course our regular weekly nonsense. And yeah, until, you know, next we meet, I really wish I lived in the world where Pochita was real.
Stop fucking retweeting Cartoon Brew, they're terrible.
That too.